Hello, and welcome to another episode of Realpolitik. I am your host, Firas Mohdad, and today we're going to be talking about the war in the Middle East again, which seems to be expanding and getting worse, and really there doesn't seem to be any kind of plan to resolve it. So let's start maybe with some of the things that Donald Trump has been saying, and to focus on that. He said on the 6th of March, there will be no deal with Iran except unconditional surrender. After that, and the selection of a great and acceptable leader, we and many of our wonderful and very brave allies and partners will work tirelessly to bring Iran back from the brink of destruction, making it economically bigger, better, and stronger than ever. Make Iran great again. Asking for unconditional surrender in the first week of the war seems to be a little bit extreme, and Trump seems to have gone on a tilt, because the president of Iran did something which seems to have been not agreed by the rest of the leadership. He apologized to the countries in the region for Iran's attacks against them and said that Iran would only be attacking countries that were allowing their territories to be used against it, which is kind of understandable. That actually opened a brief window for diplomacy that could have allowed some talks and some communications. But Trump, by insta-reacting, closed that window because he said that Iran is being beat to hell, has apologized, and surrendered to its Middle East neighbors. Iran is going to be the great loser of the Middle East, and this will be for many decades until they surrender, or more likely completely collapse. And it tends to be that when you threaten a country with total collapse and total destruction, they don't like it very much. And here we have to sort of remind you of what we said last week about Shia theology. The entirety of the Shia identity is based on the supporters of Ali, and his children, the nephew and son-in-law of the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, having failed to back him in the Battle of Karbala in southern Iraq. And so for the Shia, their slogan is death over humiliation. And what Trump seems to be offering them is either humiliation or death, and they tend to choose death. They can be quite stubborn that way. So far, there is no evidence of any talks between the Iranians and the Americans. There is no evidence of any talks between Hezbollah and the Israelis, because Hezbollah has been activated since we last spoke, and it's now going on the offensive against Israel, and things to be quite stuck. So this is a good moment to sort of assess the strategies of the different sides and to try to understand what their real capabilities are and how does this seem to be going. Now, Trump said that he wants tankers to go through the Strait of Hormuz and just show some guts, by which he means risking getting sunk. And he claims that there's nothing to be afraid of because the Iranians don't have a navy and the US has sunk all of their ships. Here, it's good to look at a map and to sort of compare different things and try to understand what we're talking about. When you had the Houthi shut down Bab al-Mandab, the strait at the entrance of the Red Sea here, they were operating from this area northwards. And arguably, their main concentration of power was along Hudaydah here, meaning that ships could go through the strait and then get attacked. And then in all of the instances where the American Navy escorted ships and the Houthis attacked, they were able to go ahead unimpeded. And this was because the Houthi were in control of this territory here, from Ma'rib through Sana'a down to Ibn Ta'iz and then up north and this coastal area. And they were firing at ships as they were in transit. The geography of Hormuz is quite different. The geography of Hormuz basically gives the Iranians three different directions from which they can attack ships as they go through the narrows. And that makes it a lot more risky because the Iranians aren't going to be using their navy, which is incompetent and, as Trump has said, is largely destroyed. The Iranians will be using drones and ballistic missiles fired from pretty close by with lower detection times because the ships are stuck in the middle of the strait. So the risk that is being taken is going to be considerably larger. And while this area in general has been pounded, what we saw with the Houthi was that even after 45 days of American attacks using two aircraft carriers, they were still able to attack ships. Not damage them or sink them while they're being escorted, but still able to conduct enough attacks. And so in this configuration, as the ships go through the bend here, they're going to be a lot more vulnerable. And that's why shippers are hesitant, which is logical at the end of the day. Which brings us to understanding maybe the Iranian strategy and why they are refusing talks. I mean, the conversation between Iran and the U.S., such as it is going so badly that Witkoff and Kushner, who were supposed to visit Israel and maybe see if it's time to end the war and declare victory, simply decided not to show up, which tells you that things aren't really going great. And the Iranian strategy is this, essentially. What they have successfully done is cause enormous damage to the radar systems of the United States throughout the region and to the bases that the United States is using to attack Iran. So they've destroyed a radar in Qatar, another in the UAE, a third one in Kuwait, I believe, another one in Bahrain, another one in Jordan. So the Iranian play at the opening of the war was to attack as many radars as they could so that detecting and therefore intercepting their missiles would be harder. And to do that, they used a very heavy wave of attacks in the initial days of the war. But now, because the detection capability has been degraded and even some of the replacement radars have been attacked, they don't need to maintain the same tempo. So I'm seeing here in the comments that, okay, the number of Iranian missiles has gone down and has gone down significantly. And this is absolutely true. The Iranians are firing much less. That's because of two reasons. One of them is their capability has also been degraded. That is not in dispute. The other reason is because they don't need to fire as many missiles as they needed to. What the Iranians are trying to do is to completely paralyze the economies of the Gulf and to shut down energy shipping, to shut down even energy production, to shut down aviation, and therefore to cripple the global economy. That's the play that they're engaged in. And so you're seeing European gas prices spike, not as badly as they spiked during the Russian invasion of Ukraine, for instance, but still a significant enough spike to basically damage every single manufacturer in Europe. There's a very real risk of physical energy shortages, that there simply wouldn't be enough oil on the market to meet demand. This can be ameliorated by various countries opening their strategic petroleum reserves, but even that is seen by the markets as a sign that there is going to be a shortage into the future. And since those markets mainly operate on futures contracts rather than on spot contracts, this price event is going to carry over into the months ahead. Plus, there's going to be enormous damage to agriculture. Something like 45% of all urea exports, which are necessary in the production of fertilizers, come through the Strait of Hormuz. And with these being shut in largely because shipping is shut in, the impact of that is going to be higher fertilizer prices right before the planting season, meaning that farmers will need to recover their costs down the line, meaning that food supply for the coming year is going to be damaged. You plant in March, you harvest in September, the inputs that go into the March planting are what you factor in when you price in September. So the food inflation shockwave is going to carry over into the future, just as the energy inflation shockwave is going to carry over into the future. So the Iranian strategy here doesn't require them to maintain the same rate of fire indefinitely. They don't need to do that. What they need to do is to do what they did to Dubai Airport. When yesterday there was talk of Dubai Airport opening, the Iranians landed a drone in it. And just with one drone, they managed to keep it shut down. They don't need to physically destroy the infrastructure. They need to keep everything bottled in. Requiring the American Navy to go deep into the strait and fight its way through there, especially with the naval base in Bahrain having been largely destroyed and the fuel depots in Bahrain having been largely destroyed, meaning that the ships need to exit the strait to refuel and then come back, that is where the Iranians will actually reveal what capabilities they have against shipping. And so Trump is essentially threatening death and damnation, but we haven't fully seen what the Iranians can do in terms of the strait. Now, if the American Navy starts organizing convoys and they are escorting ships out of the strait and they are keeping it open, there is still going to be a geopolitical risk premium, which means that the prices would be higher because the insurance costs are going to be higher, because every other cost is going to be higher. And my understanding is that insuring a ship that would have cost $250,000 before the war started now costs $3 million. This insurance rate will stay up and costs will stay up and the price of energy will stay up, but not to the same extent. So the Iranians will be able to do continuous damage to the world economy in terms of inflation, even if things get somewhat better. And Trump is asking for unconditional surrender, which fundamentally goes against the ideology of Iran. That's why, after the Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei was killed, the assembly of experts, who are 88 religious scholars tasked with overseeing the work of the Supreme Leader and selecting his replacement, they chose Ali Khamenei's second son, Mujtaba. And this is a guy who is deeply involved in the inner workings of the regime. He knows the economic side through his influence over his father's financial empire, which extends into all kinds of charitable, quote unquote, establishments that actually are major economic actors in Iran. And they're called the Bunyads. And they control maybe 30% of the economy. Another 30% is controlled by the IRGC, and then the 40% is everybody else. He can basically communicate with both the merchant classes and the religious establishment and the IRGC, and therefore provide regime continuity. And the message from the Iranians in having elected Mujtaba is a big F you to Trump. No, we're not going to give up. We're not going to surrender. And the reason they feel that they are in a strong enough position is because the tempo of the war has changed. And the reason the tempo of the war has changed is because a lot of these bases and these radars have been successfully or sufficiently damaged in order to make it viable for Iran to use a smaller number of attack drones and ballistic missiles and hypersonic missiles to achieve their objective. And that's kind of what we're seeing in terms of what's coming out of, say, Haaretz. Haaretz is saying that that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, are admitting that they're struggling to intercept Hezbollah's drones from Lebanon, which, it's a different interception system than that is used against Iranian missiles, is what I want to say, because against Hezbollah drones you use the Iron Dome system, whereas against the ballistic missiles you use a combination of HETS arrow and the THAAD interceptors, but they're struggling with those. And the reason that is important is because when Hezbollah activated, the first thing that it did was attack radar bases in Israel so that it would use the drones to damage their radars to make it easier for the Iranians to attack with bigger missiles. So that's the synergy between the two sides. And one of the things that we're seeing, according to the Israelis, is coordinated attacks between Iran and Hezbollah. Now, why is this important? It's important because it means that there is command, control, and communication that is still ongoing between Iran and Hezbollah, despite the early shock and awe attacks that the Americans and the Israelis have engaged in. If they can still coordinate and cooperate, it means that there is still command and control, which is, I would say, very important. And the question then becomes, how are they communicating? Well, given Hezbollah's humiliation when it tried to buy its own communication equipments like the pagers, they're probably going to rely on China. And if the Chinese systems are difficult to access for American intelligence, then that's a real problem for Israel and the United States. And you see the results of this in this kind of video, where you are seeing serious damage and impacts by Iranian missiles in central Tel Aviv. We don't fully know the extent of damage in Israel, because, as you know, there's an office of the Israeli military censor, and he sits on top of all media production, both domestic Israeli and foreign. And if you don't obey the military censor, you very quickly get deported. So the Chinese sent a crew to see one of the impact sites where an Iranian missile had fallen. And within 5 minutes, security forces were there telling them to just go away immediately. So the Israelis are hiding the extent of damage that they're taking. Mind you, the Iranians themselves are taking enormous damage. There is no disputing that. The Israelis blew up pretty much the entirety of the fuel storage capability that the Iranians had up and down the country in all kinds of places, especially in Tehran. And they argued that these were linked to refineries that benefit the IRGC. Well, obviously, most things in the Iranian economy either benefit the IRGC or they benefit the clerical establishment. That's simply how the economy works. In the same way that most things in the Western economy benefit either BlackRock or Vanguard or State Street or one of these types of investors. So it's a bit of a lame argument to say that this doesn't affect civilians, it's only an attack on the IRGC. But that's a separate conversation for later. What seems to be happening, though, is that with the damage to the radars, the Iranians can afford to fire a smaller number of missiles and to still cause damage with these missiles. And that is evidence of a somewhat successful strategy. Obviously, time will tell how successful it is. But what I'm trying to do here is to explain to you what the Iranian approach to war is, and to say that a decline in the rate of fire from the Iranians doesn't really matter so long as political objectives are being achieved. And the political objectives here are being achieved relatively well. So basically, a bunch of American tankers that were deployed in Saudi Arabia and the King Sultan Air and the Prince Sultan Air Base left to Europe. And that's either because the Saudis said, you can no longer operate out of our territory because we take the Iranian threat to attack our energy infrastructure more severely, quite seriously, or it's because these bases have been damaged enough by Iranian missiles. But the end result is the same, because one of the things that the Iranians are working on is to make it obvious to the Gulf states that they can't have security without the Iranians having security. Meaning that if the Gulf states still give the Americans access to their bases and to their airspace and to their territory, they themselves aren't safe. And so what we've seen on the back of that is that basically there's been force majeure declared by Kuwait, there's been force majeure declared by Bahrain, by Iraq, by Qatar, and the Saudis are reducing their production. Essentially, the Iranians have forced the countries of the Middle East to participate in an energy blockade. And the problem, unlike what Trump is saying, isn't that the ships are too cowardly to go through the strait and risk being hit by missiles and drones by the Iranians. The problem is that the Gulf states have been forced to engage in an energy boycott against the West because they know that the kinds of missiles that are now being used against Tel Aviv that are penetrating Israeli air defenses can be used against their own energy far more effectively. And so you're seeing the Iranians attack some targets still in the Gulf states. The apology from the Iranian president, Pezeshkian, it was completely disregarded by the IRGC, and the IRGC went on numerous, enormous rants against him. But the end result is that they've succeeded in imposing this energy blockade. And the Gulf states still believe that if they were to try to break that blockade and export energy to the rest of the world, their own infrastructure actually gets destroyed. The energy in the Gulf basically has a number of very vulnerable choke points. These include some storage facilities in the city of Fujairah, here on the other end of Hormuz, and these have been attacked. They include the Habashan facility somewhere around here in the middle of the UAE, which is kind of an energy city where pretty much all of the processing of the energy gets done. So it all gets done in this kind of facility. What happens is that there's a bunch of pipelines that go out into the oil fields. The pipelines terminate here in this facility that you see. It gets processed, and then it gets pipelined again to the export terminals in Abu Dhabi and on the other side in Fujairah. But that's a huge single point of failure. And if the Iranians hit it with 3, 5, 6 ballistic missiles, it's destroyed for 5 years, 10 years, as opposed to what's currently happening, which is hitting storage facilities with a drone, which slows down the process of exports, but it doesn't cause a permanent crippling of the energy industry. And that's a big facility in the UAE. There's another one, Abqaiq, in Saudi Arabia. There is Mina Ahmadi in Kuwait, which has been kind of hit, but not as badly as it could be. And these various bits and pieces of infrastructure can be destroyed with larger ballistic missiles, which the Iranians still have, which they need to fire at a lower rate, which are the main threat that is being wielded against the region. That's why you're getting an energy boycott, or that's why you're getting an energy embargo. And that still functions even with a lower rate of attacks. And if you're watching media in the Middle East, which for my sins I have to do, on every single Arab media channel broadcasting out of the region, Arabiya in Saudi Arabia, Jazeera in Qatar, Sky News in the UAE, you're constantly hearing the presenters' phones going off with alerts coming in of incomings. And what this means is that there is a small, steady tempo of attacks by drones that are being used to hit all kinds of targets to cause enough damage to make it expensive, and to remind these countries that worse can be done against them. So that's how the Iranians are playing their hand. They knocked out a bunch of the radars relatively successfully. Hezbollah is being used to knock out Israeli radars, especially in the north. And that allows them to shut down energy, shipping, and aviation for the whole region. And this is before the Houthi get activated. And the Houthi in Yemen are certainly going to get activated, because the Gerald Ford is supposedly on its way from the Eastern Mediterranean through the Red Sea and onwards into the Indian Ocean to participate more fully in the attacks against Iran. But what is that going to do? When the Houthi see that ship passing, they're going to throw everything that they have at the carrier and the strike group that is coming with it, because carriers never travel on their own. They travel with a pair of destroyers and frigates and all kinds of, and Aegis cruisers, I meant to say, and all kinds of things. And so they will try to draw down the interceptors that these ships have before they reach the Iranian theater, so that the Iranians have an easier time attacking them. And what you're seeing essentially is that this strategy is spreading across the region. So in Iraq, because there is talk of the Kurds being used as foot soldiers to enter into Iran and to try to cause chaos in Iran and engage the Iranian security forces and military in a ground war, you're seeing the Iranians lobbing drones and missiles and so on at the headquarters of the Kurdish militias that are supposed to be used in that role. And things are so bad that the Syrian Kurds, who were used by the United States against Islamic State and then discarded when the Turks wanted them discarded, these guys are saying to Iranian Kurds, don't partner with the United States, they're going to turn around and betray you. And all over Iraq, you're seeing attacks against American interests, including in the south. I think Halliburton was hit in Basra. And the idea is to cause so much damage to American business interests all over the region that the region isn't worth staying in for American businesses, meaning that the big lobbying influence that tries to keep the U.S. in the Middle East is gone because they've lost so much. And what we're seeing is that the Iranians have pretty detailed knowledge of Americans' movements. So when they moved some of their, when the Americans moved some personnel to a port in Kuwait, that got hit. When they moved a bunch of guys from the Navy into a hotel in Bahrain, the hotel got hit. And that's because there are so many Persians in the Gulf and there are so many Shia in the Gulf. Plus, probably, the Chinese are helping the Iranians with their intelligence and their communications. And if you look at it from a Chinese perspective, they have nothing to lose by backing Iran. The more the Iranian, the more the Americans get bogged down against Iran, the more they deplete their resources, and the easier it is for China to one day take Taiwan. So they view this as a potential win for them. Plus, the Iranians are not imposing an embargo on exports to China, and China has the option of investing a lot more in Central Asia in order to boost the production of everything from coal to uranium to natural gas to oil to try to compensate for at least some of its dependence on the Middle East. And Russia and China are working closely together and they're building more pipelines between them, meaning that the Russians are going to make the effort in order to prioritize China because they themselves rely on Chinese components for their own military. So what the Americans have done is sort of increase the synergy between China, Central Asia, and Russia. And if the nightmare scenario for a maritime power like the United States is a united Eurasia, they are willing into being precisely that nightmare by engaging in this war. And it doesn't seem that there is any kind of strategy on the part of the United States other than destroy them. But you need to have some kind of viable political objective. And when Trump says things like, I'm going to choose the next Iranian supreme leader, and I'm going to make sure that he's on board with me, like, it doesn't really work. And if it is going to work, it is going to take a long war, which the global economy cannot afford. So there is no viable process here. If this oil remains shut down, you're going to end up in chaos in countries like Jordan and Egypt and Lebanon and Morocco and Tunisia and Bangladesh and India and Pakistan. Because all of these countries have something in common. They rely on Gulf investments. They rely on the Gulf states having enough money. And they rely on remittances from the Gulf. So the longer the war continues, the bigger the pressure on these countries' economies. And the Iranian play is, we will cause global chaos rather than surrender. And when you are of that mindset, you're probably not going to give up in a week or two. This is probably going to have to be a pretty long war to make somebody with that ideology actually give up. And given that the Shia are quite messianic in their thinking, yeah, you can see this war continuing for a while. And remember, they don't need to maintain the same tempo. Now for China, because the Iranians aren't blockading shipments to them, and because they have Russian shipping as an alternative source of supply, and because if there's going to be a physical shortage, the Russians are going to give priority to the Chinese rather than to South Korea or Japan or maybe even India, they're going to end up paying a much higher cost in energy. That is going to make the Russians richer. That is going to make it easier for the Russians to fight in Ukraine, especially because of the interceptors and the air defense systems are being prioritized for the Middle East. But the Chinese will survive this. And the Russians would rather allow other countries fail, on which they do not depend for their own manufactured goods, than allow China to fail. So if you're Russia, who are you going to give priority to? Probably India, because India really matters to Russia. As we've explained in the past, the Russian dream is to be able to contain China somewhat in partnership with India and Iran, and definitely China, because they need China in order to pursue their war in Ukraine. So yes, the Chinese are going to pay a higher cost, but everybody else is going to suffer more than they are. And when it comes to the economy, it's all about your competitive advantage. It's not just about what you're paying, it is also about what everyone else is paying. Because if everyone else is equally suffering, but you're suffering slightly less, you are at a more advantageous position than, say, Europe, which the Russians are obviously going to deprioritize, with the exception of a couple of friendly countries like maybe Slovakia and Hungary, who are stuck in the middle of their own fight with Ukraine. So there doesn't seem to be a strategy to address this. And on the microchips front, there is a huge amount of helium that comes out of the Gulf. The helium is necessary to, in various cooling processes in the manufacturing of semiconductors. The Chinese went ahead and tried to build a much bigger helium production capability for their own, and they are going to use that. And you will see countries turning to all kinds of economic nationalism, where any domestic production of critical goods that are made unavailable by the blockade on the Strait of Hormuz are going to be banned to export markets. And they will prioritize domestic markets. And arguably for Trump in a midterm year, he doesn't want to see $5 oil. So he will have to restrict energy exports out of the United States in order to make sure that oil prices in the United States are at a good enough price. Of course, all of these impacts are going to be mitigated by the release of enormous amounts of strategic reserves. China has 1.3 billion barrels of oil. Japan has a pretty decent amount of storage. European gas storage is really a problem. And with the Qataris shutting down LNG exports, that's going to be a real problem for them. But you will see people releasing their strategic reserves. But over time, there's going to be shortages. And the shortages are going to trigger more economic nationalism. And what this war ends up doing is that it integrates China, Central Asia, and Russia more closely, whereas it disintegrates globalization for other parts of the world. And the Europeans, because of the perfidy and foolishness of their leaders, end up paying a bigger price. And it has to be said that regimes like Iran's are almost never toppled just by an air campaign. It doesn't really work that way. To actually impose your will on somebody, you have to deploy soldiers on the ground, or you have to impose regime change by just killing enough of the leadership. But as we said in the previous episode, the command of the IRGC has been deliberately decentralized since 2008 because they've been worried about a decapitation strike for that long. And the more the Americans kill political leaders in Iran, the stronger the IRGC becomes. And because they see this as a war for survival, where if they come out of the war without some kind of "we were steadfast, we survived, and therefore we were victorious" narrative, they're not going to be able to govern Iran. They're going to have to stay in the fight for as long as they physically can. And given that Yemen took 45 days and ended with the Houthis still in power, you can then project and say, well, it's going to take at least 45 days for the Iranians to be fully defeated. Because again, it's not about the volume of missiles. It's about retaining the ability to cause damage if energy exports resume, if flights resume, if shipping resumes. That's the name of the game. And the success of this is shown by the fact that the Americans have left Saudi Arabia's Prince Sultan Airbase, and is shown by the fact that Gulf states like Kuwait and Qatar and Saudi Arabia and Iraq and probably the UAE have always had to restrict their exports, even though this is not the result of just physical damage. It is the result of the Iranians threatening them and saying, if you disobey us, we will destroy you. So this is where we are in the war right now, and it doesn't really seem to be going particularly well for the United States. And all of this is aside from the fact that, you know, even if the Americans destroy Iran and destroy the regime, it may not solve the problem in the Gulf. Let's sort of take a pause here and think about history. Way back when, in between 1100-something and 1250-something, you had something called the Hashashin. Now, who were the Hashashin? They were wonderful people. Legend has it that these guys were fanatical Shia, first of all. And legend has it was that these guys would have their people smoke a bunch of dope and then take them to a place where there was a lot of water and a lot of beautiful women and so on, and tell them that this is paradise, and that if they wanted to go back to paradise, all they had to do was to assassinate somebody. And they had a string of fortresses, especially along the Syrian coast and in Iran. And what you get if you collapse the Iranian regime could easily be Hashashin with drones, assassins with drones, whereby instead of actually submitting to the United States, these guys go full-on fanatical and use the mountains of Iran and the mountains around the Persian Gulf to just keep lobbing missiles into the region around them and blackmailing all of the countries there into giving them economic concessions and paying them money, otherwise they'd bomb them. So even destroying the Iranians' regime doesn't actually guarantee victory. And that's one possible outcome that we should consider. Another outcome could be some kind of compromise, some version of Trump always chickens out, where he sees the damage to the economy, he sees this is deeply unpopular within the Republican Party, although it seems that some people are lying to Trump and convincing him that it actually has support, which is nonsense. But Trump decides that, you know what, this is enough. I can claim victory and walk away and say that this is fine. But then what you get is that the Iranians gain credibility because they would have survived an onslaught by the United States, lost a bunch of their leaders, suffered enormous economic damage, but in the end survived. And depending on how weakened the Iranians are, that could be the exact moment where the Turks make a move on northern Iraq. And we're already hearing noises from Israel that Turkey is the next Iran and Turkey is a threat. And if they control the energy resources that are in this area and in Kirkuk especially, the Turks end up the big winners of this. And you could argue that this might pave the way for a Turkish-Iranian conflict and this war escalating. And you could obviously argue that a stronger Turkey is going to pave the way for a Turkish-Israeli conflict, which is where things are heading right now. And let's say this becomes a three-month war instead of a, you know, 2 weeks, 10, 15 days war. Well, obviously, the Iranians would have gained a lot more influence over the Gulf, because all of the Gulf states would know that unless they invest in Iran and make concessions to the Iranians, their assets are going to be hit. And obviously, if you're Russia and China, you're going to help the Iranian military to rebuild if the regime survives, because you want to make the next attempt by the United States more expensive. And indeed, from the Iranian perspective, they don't want to make this a short war. They want to make this a longer war that is so expensive to the United States that they don't come back and do this again. And then the last possibility is that this goes nuclear. And it could go nuclear, for example, because the U.S. decides to walk away from the war, but the Iranians say we're going to continue fighting Israel. Obviously, that would... Initially, the Americans would say, no, we want to fully back the war. But if the Iranians say, we will end the oil blockade if you end the war, and we will just keep lobbing missiles into Israel until they give up against Hezbollah, who knows how that plays out? And the Iranians have enriched uranium, 60%. A viable bomb requires at least 80% enriched uranium. The first bombs used in World War II were 80% enriched, maybe they could get to that number. So there is no way to think through how badly can this damage the world. Because countries like India are going to be screaming over energy prices and food prices. So is Pakistan. So is all of Africa. So is big chunks of Latin America. And if there's a physical oil shortage, that ends up leading to demand destruction. Because governments will say, well, either we have to supply fuel to industry or we have to heat homes and give electricity to homes. So a long war like this can be immensely destructive, not to mention the various ways in which it could expand. Already, Lebanon and Hezbollah are fully at war, and Hezbollah seems to be holding its own for now. And they're surprising the Israelis with their capabilities, meaning that they've been able to recover from the earlier defeat. And they have obviously dispersed their military far more. And they're seeing this in more existential terms. Because the things that are happening in Lebanon is that on the one side, the government is working towards a peace treaty with Israel, which Hezbollah absolutely doesn't want, and if it is going to happen, they want it on their terms. And the Israelis are never going to accept Hezbollah's terms, and vice versa. So there's a real threat of this Israel-Lebanon war lasting for a long time, and Iran saying, we're not going to end the war against Israel unless it ends the war against Hezbollah. And then you see different pathways towards this getting worse. So North Lebanon, this Tripoli area here, up through Halba, up through Kbayat, and even in parts of Hirmil, this is a very Sunni area. And they absolutely hate Hezbollah with a passion. And we're seeing Syrian forces building up along the border with the possibility of them going into Lebanon. What would that do? Well, it could activate the Alawites in Syria and drive them to try to expand southwards, with Hezbollah trying to move northwards against the Sunnis. And if this becomes a bad enough situation for the Sunnis along the Syrian coast, and the whole Syrian coast in this area is largely Alawite, then who does that invite in? Well, it invites in Turkey. And if you're Cyprus and you're Greece, you don't want Turkey building up more capability along what is essentially the front line against Cyprus. And that becomes a problem. And already we're seeing that Israel, Cyprus, and Greece are working towards a military alliance to contain Turkey. And they're being backed by France in this. So there's a pathway there for this to end up involving the Turks in a much bigger way. And that quickly becomes disastrous. And then the Israelis have to choose their poison. Would they rather work with the Shia, who are hammering them with missiles? Or would they rather risk the Sunnis winning and the Sunnis ending up in a much stronger position against Israel than the Shia ever could be? And that can obviously rope in Europe if, you know, Article 5 is activated, if the attacks on Cyprus continue. So it doesn't seem to me that anybody has thought through the second order consequences. And indeed, this is natural for the United States. Because for the United States to maintain its position as a superpower, what it needs is chaos in regions all over the world in order to make sure that no regional hegemon anywhere in the world becomes powerful enough to challenge the United States. The problem is that the policy that is being pursued is creating just such a hegemon, which is China, the world's manufacturing superpower, partnering with Russia and Central Asia, the world's natural resource superpowers, while Europe ends up suffering endlessly because of the foolishness of its leaders, because of the waves of immigration, because of higher energy prices, and so on and so forth. So there doesn't seem to be a real plan beyond we're going to bomb the Iranians until they submit. And maybe they will submit. Maybe they do. But if this becomes a three-month war, let alone, as has been talked about in some media, a war that continues until September, then we have a completely transformed world. And with these energy prices and with this level of debt that's in the West, you're going to get a massive amount of inflation, and governments are going to be stuck. If they raise interest rates to manage inflation, it'll kill off investment, and it will mean that their debt repayments are a lot higher. And if they lower interest rates, well, that is going to lead to even more inflation. And maybe that's their only way of devaluing the debt. And maybe that becomes the argument for digital currencies. We are going to fix prices and do that through digital currency. Who knows what exactly is going to happen here? But it looks like a mess, and the Iranians have a strategy and the Americans don't. And the Iranian strategy is based on the premise that at some point, because of the economic pressure, the Americans have to give up. But what if the Americans don't? Because they have their own energy supplies, and they can restrict energy exports and let the rest of the world deal with the foolishness of net zero. In which case, everybody else pays the price. The Israelis pay a heavy price. But the U.S. ends up doing well, and that is good enough for them. And already we're seeing this war being used as an excuse to basically boost defense production. So they've promised Trump that they're going to quadruple the production of PAC-3 interceptors, THAADs, all kinds of other interceptors that are necessary, AMRAAM missiles, standard missiles, everything that they need. So the war provides a good excuse for that. Boosting that production at a sustainable price requires policing energy prices in the United States, which obviously makes Europe suffer enormously. The U.S. is saying that they're going to accelerate the production of the B-21, their sixth-generation bomber. And so in this war, even if the Americans don't achieve anything because they don't have a strategy, they still win. And the problem that the Iranians have is that they're a nation state fighting as an insurgency. But things don't work that way. You can use insurgents as proxies if you have a nation state backing them. But when a nation state turns itself into an insurgency, that's just a suicidal option. Except that with Shia theology, that is the only acceptable option. And the IRGC still has a pretty strong grip on power, and the war is making people more nationalistic. And even Hamas, stuck in Gaza with everything getting destroyed, was able to hold out for 18 months and keep fighting for that duration. So you could easily see a situation in which the Iranians fight for 6 months, and this thing simply just destroying the world economy. Let's see. Shall we have a look at some of the questions, some of the comments from you guys? What do you guys think about this? Let us see. Oh, there's a bunch of them. This almost looks like the U.S. is trying to push Armageddon. Because the Middle East is the linchpin of Armageddon, they may actually succeed. Look, we've spoken about this. I spoke about this on the podcast on Monday, where I discussed how certain groups in Israel want to build the third temple, and how parts of the American administration believe that this is the way to go. I don't think that this is the actual objective of the war, but these kinds of forces drive escalation, and these kinds of beliefs have consequences. You can't understand geopolitics without understanding the beliefs that are animating the different actors. And for a big bunch of the Israeli right and a big bunch of the evangelicals, yeah, Armageddon is a good thing. Like I keep saying, if you are certain that, you know, when the second coming happens, you're going to be among those who are saved, I fundamentally don't trust you. But that's kind of what we're seeing. Can you fully defeat a messianic leadership? That's why I said that one of the options is Hashashin with drones. That they basically get crushed as a state, but if you're Russia and you want to maintain a high oil price, you give these crazies enough drones to cause enough disruption in the region to maintain your position and to blackmail Europe and the West. So that's the that's the thinking here. Let's see. Arizona Desert Rat says, I would love for the U.S. to pull out of the Middle East and let the whole region implode on itself. Unfortunately, you get either the Iranians or the Turks if that happens. However, I know there are plenty of countries and groups who would still attack the U.S. and its allies for simply existing. Yeah. Like, the Muslims are never going to tolerate the existence of a Jewish state. And even if they were inclined to do that, it wouldn't be this kind of state animated by such a chauvinistic, expansionist ideology. That's part of the problem. Iran's plan is clever, although I wonder, why wouldn't they fully cripple the other Gulf countries' energy infrastructure? The game here is sort of mutual deterrence. So the Americans began complaining when the Israelis attacked the infrastructure within Iran, the energy infrastructure within Iran, because they understood that the Iranian retaliation to that would be to attack the actual full-on infrastructure in the ports and in the main processing facilities in the Gulf. And so they would try to maintain this leverage and keep this from going completely crazy. The issue is that the Americans are thinking about seizing Kharg Island. Now, Kharg Island is this location just at the very top of the Strait of Hormuz, where most of the Iranians' own processing happens. So if you think of Abqaiq or Habshan in Saudi Arabia and the UAE, respectively, the Iranian version of that is this island called Kharg Island. And the Americans are saying that maybe we just go there and seize it. Well, then you guarantee either that an Iranian insurgency blows up all of their own pipelines to stop that oil from being exploited by the United States, or that they blow up the processing facilities in neighboring countries and therefore make this completely zero sum for everyone. And it goes on until you get Hashashin with drones. So that's the play here. This is starting to sound like Trump is speedrunning his own version of Vietnam, Afghanistan. In other words, a pointless forever war that lasts a couple of weeks, months, but that costs him and his masters a lot of goodwill. I mean, this is really one of the big problems for the Israelis, that nobody is afraid anymore of saying that this, just like the Iraq war, just like the Syria war, just like Libya, was being done for Israel. And if it's done for Israel and the oligarchy is benefiting from it, then the public needs to punish Israel and the oligarchy. And after the financial crisis, the 2008 financial crisis, there is so much goodwill lost between the government and the governed all over the world. And this only accelerated with the stupid reaction to COVID, that you've reached a point now where the only way to have credibility, politically speaking, is to say that I'm going to punish the oligarchs and dissociate from Israel. That's the only thing that can unite the left and the right and build you a winning electoral coalition. And so, yeah, you're absolutely right in your analysis. It is a pointless forever war that costs him and the oligarchs an enormous amount. Arizona Desert Rat, the U.S. can alleviate the shortages by using its own wells and increasing nuclear. Well, nuclear takes a long time to build. That's the main problem with nuclear. It takes, you know, I think the UAE did it very quickly in 7 years, 5 years, something like that, in partnership with South Korea. So it's possible, but it takes a long time. And the current American production, with this higher oil price, it can be increased further. And that's why the Americans are least affected by this. And the US is going to make money out of this. And that's what's stupid about the Iranian strategy. It's punishing the rest of the world. It's punishing the region. But it isn't punishing the Americans as badly. And the objective here is to create deterrence. So, yes, there are these solutions as far as the US is concerned. But the Chinese also have their own solutions via Central Asia and via Russia. But the Chinese solutions take longer, except that now that this has happened, they're definitely going to pursue them, which in the end makes the entire Gulf poorer, which in the end means that all kinds of countries that depend on the Gulf being rich get much less investment and remittances. So the damage from some of this is probably going to be permanent. Drake Heath says, the point of this war is to keep Netanyahu and Trump out of prison. I don't see any other reason except the insane prophecies the leadership of all sides keep bringing up. For Netanyahu, this is, as he has said, a dream come true. This is the fulfillment of all of his dreams. This is the fulfillment of all of his ambitions. Except now he's developed an ambition of destroying Turkey, which is a whole different ballgame. And you can see that if this works against Iran, they're going to try to do the same against Turkey in the foreseeable future. And basically, as I said on the Peter McCormack show, no matter what you do, no matter who you vote for, you get John McCain. Because remember, when it comes to Iraq and Afghanistan, George W. Bush promised a more restrained American foreign policy before being elected. Then Obama gets elected, and he promises a more restrained foreign policy, and he delivers Libya and Syria. And then you got Biden, and he actually delivered a withdrawal from Afghanistan in the dumbest way possible, in the most humiliating way possible, and arguably the military wanted it to look humiliating so that they could teach any other president that if you say no to our wars, this is what we will do to you. But then you got Trump again, and he delivers an Iran war. So it's getting to a point where voting doesn't matter. And that's a really dangerous point for a democratic system to be in. You've got to throw the voters a bone. You've got to give them some concessions. So regardless of what the point of this war is, if it's to sort of keep Trump and Netanyahu out of prison or whatever, like, it's leading to a situation where everybody's getting much more radicalized. And objectively, this is not a good thing. Because radicalized people do radical things. And you could argue that things have gotten so bad that there are only radical solutions. But once you get into non-democratic solutions, these are by definition violent. And trust me, you don't want civil war. It's an absolutely horrible thing to have. So the main problem with this war is the extent to which it is discrediting the system as a system. And that's the main impact. And that's how people like Trump and the oligarchy and the Democratic Party and the GOP establishment are going to pay for it. It is going to end up completely discrediting them. It already has discredited them because from a just war theory, there is no justification for this war. The key part of what a just war theory is that it has to be defensive and necessary. And the benefits of going to war have to exceed the costs of war. And there should be a reasonable chance of success. And you should distinguish between combatants and non-combatants. When you bomb the energy facilities of a country, and when you bomb hospitals and schools, which has already happened, you're not distinguishing between civilians and non-civilians. When you say that we're just going to bomb everybody indefinitely, when there was a political agreement on the table that would have removed a nuclear threat, you can't argue that this was necessary. And by definition, given where the United States is and where Iran is, this is not a defensive war because the United States are not defending themselves. You could say, well, they're defending an ally, but it was the ally that said that they were going to attack anyway. And that itself was a revealing statement. When somebody like Rubio says, oh, well, the Israelis were going to do it anyway, you finance them and you give them their weapons. You can say no to them. What you're saying is that you got cucked by the oligarchy. And it's this discrediting of the system that is the main price. And if you're the Iranians, you understand this stuff. Because the Iranians understand things like the American midterms and their impact. They actually get the American political system. And they get Western political systems. They don't approve of them, but they're intellectual enough to understand them. And so if you're Iran and you can't beat the US militarily, you just tear down the system that allows the United States to exercise these wars. And to do that, you need to survive. And that's the blending of political strategy and military strategy, which is why they knocked out their radars first, and now they're okay with a slow rate of fire because they've already shut down energy, aviation, and shipping in the region. Anyway, that is it from me today. Thank you so much for joining me, and I'll see you again next week. And if you're a first-time viewer, please become a subscriber so that we can talk next week. Take care.